You have destroyed that race eternally. Once mixed with the black or yellow races, the white race would be totally and forever destroyed. Hence, God has forbidden it. For example, Psalm 144, verses 11 and 12. Rid me and deliver me from the hand of strange children. And that's the Hebrew word nekor, meaning those of another race. Rid me and deliver me from the hand of strange children, whose mouth speaketh vanity, and their right hand is a right hand of falsehood, that our sons may be as plants growing up in their youth, that our daughters may be as the polished cornices of a palace. Then take Jeremiah 2, verses 21 and 25. Yet I had planted thee a noble vine, wholly a true seed. How then art thou turned into the degenerate plant of a strange vine unto me? And again, that strange is Zur. Withhold thy foot from being unshod, and thy throat from thirst. But thou saidst, there is no hope. No, for I have loved strangers, and after them will I go. And what is the result of this? Hosea 5, verses 6 and 7 tells it. They shall go with their flocks and their herds to seek the Lord, but they shall not find him. He hath withdrawn himself from them. They have dealt treacherously against the Lord, for they have begotten strange children. And again this word Zur, showing it's a mixture of the person of another race. Now Noah was saved because he was pure-blooded, while those around him were mongrelized. The sixth chapter of Genesis, verses 2, 4, and 5, record the forbidden mixing of races and the evil results of it. But speaking of Noah, Genesis 6, verse 9 says, Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. Now that perfect is the Hebrew tamim, without blemish or fault, and the word mistranslated generations is the Hebrew teledo, which means descent or ancestry. Noah, therefore, was a just man and without any blemish in his ancestry, no mongrelization. Therefore, Noah and his family were saved while the mongrels were wiped out. Did you know that the mixing of races, the mongrelization, is the sin for which Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed? Yes, it is. Read Jude, verse 7. Even as Sodom and Gomorrah, and the cities about them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication, and going after strange flesh, are set forth for an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. Those who are trying to force integration in the schools and churches are now beginning to admit that their real purpose is to bring about racial intermarriage. They've even deceived certain well-meaning but ignorant clergymen into helping them. Even without intermarriage, just allowing Negroes into the white churches is a terrible disobedience of God. Do you say, well, I didn't read that in my Bible? That's only because mistranslation concealed it from you. No doubt you were puzzled if you read Deuteronomy 23, verse 2, as it reads in your King James Version of the Bible. A bastard shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord. Even to his tenth generation shall he not enter into the congregation of the Lord. You wondered at this, because an illegitimate child is not to blame for the sins of its parents. And besides, why should the penalty extend for 10 more generations? They might all be legitimately born. But the Hebrew word which was mistranslated bastard is the word mamzer. And it means a mixture, a half-breed or mongrel. It has nothing to do with whether the child's parents were married, but it refers to the forbidden intermixture of races. And that is why the penalty extends for 10 generations. And it shows how seriously God treats this sin. It is true that a mulatto child is not to blame for his parents' sins, but he is still a mulatto. The first generation would be a half-breed. The second would have to have at least a quarter of the dark blood, the third at least one-eighth, the fourth generation at least one-sixteenth, and so on. Carry that on to the 10th generation, and you will find that there the Negro blood may be as small as one part in 1,024. Yet God himself says that this is too much to be allowed to enter into the congregation of the Lord. Now, if you admit that your church is not worthy to be called the congregation of the Lord, then perhaps this doesn't seriously concern you. But if your church is or is trying to be the congregation of the Lord, hadn't you better obey God's own commandment concerning it? There must be no integration in the churches. It's a violation of God's own direct commandment. The unfortunate children of such marriages are not the guilty ones, of course. The sin is that of their parents. Yet the fact that they cannot help what they are doesn't change the permanent fact that they are what they are. The experience of thousands of years has demonstrated that the dark races do not have what it takes to produce the white man's high civilization. They've never had it in their own lands, and they only have it here because we, the white majority, created it and maintained it. The mixed breed is the same. It does not have in proper measure those qualities which God so carefully implanted in the white race to carry out certain purposes which he has assigned to them. Recognition that God himself made the races different does not imply hatred or contempt for any of them. Difference has its purposes, which must be respected. I do not expect the family cat to sing like a canary, nor the canary to keep mice out of the kitchen. If I went quail hunting, I wouldn't expect a horse to point quail for me. Neither would I try to saddle and ride the best hunting dog in the world. All the family pets are equally loved, and neither is despised because he can't do what some other does. But each has his own purpose, and trying to mix them up or interbreed them can only harm them. Now, I know there are many people to whom these facts about the Bible are new. There are also many who have learned the evil lesson that they can get more money or more political popularity by violating these laws of God than by obeying them. Some of you may not like to be reminded of these things, but remember, I didn't write the Bible. God wrote it through his prophets, and his commandments are always right. For our own good, for the very survival of our white race upon the earth, and that we may face our own God with a better conscience, we'd better obey these laws of God. Today I want to talk about a subject in which you have been terribly misinformed in your churches, and that is, whom did Moses marry? You are all familiar with the famous saying, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, and this is true. A little knowledge is never enough. It never gets beyond half-truth, which mislead one into false beliefs. This is more consistently true in the field of religion than in almost all other fields. I am frequently challenged on some point by someone who has just this little half-truth knowledge and thinks that he has found a fallacy in the Bible's great truth that God's people Israel are known today as the Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, and Teutonic peoples, and they are and always have been under God's express command to keep their race pure. One instance of this is the challenge frequently made. Why shouldn't whites marry Negroes? Moses married an Ethiopian woman. They base this upon the way Numbers 12, verse 1, reads in the King James Version of the Bible, which says, "And Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman." Christianity has never labored under a greater curse than the many mistranslations in the King James Version. And some of them have even been followed in some other translations because these errors have become traditional. Bible scholars know that there are many thousands of mistranslations in the King James Version of the Bible. The eminent scholar Robert Young, author of Young's Analytical Concordance to the Bible and of Young's Literal Translation to the Bible, says in the preface to his literal translation that in the King James Version, there are scarcely two consecutive verses where there is not some departure from the original, and these variations may be counted by tens of thousands, as admitted on all hands. Therefore, when you think that you've found some discrepancy in God's Word, some contradiction which can be used as the foundation for conflicting doctrines. You can never safely rely upon what you find in the English translation until you have checked it in a good lexicon, preferably the Hebrew and Greek dictionaries included in Strong's exhaustive concordance, which is more thorough than most others. You will often find that defective scholarship in early translations has become accepted as doctrine and is therefore continued, although the original word will not support the meaning given to it in the translation. Now let's get back to Moses and his wife. In the Hebrew of Numbers 12, verse 1, it does not say Ethiopian because that's a Greek word and Moses was not writing in Greek. It says Cushi, a Cushite, a descendant of Cush, or a resident of the land of Cush. You remember that Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Genesis 10, verse 6 tells us that the sons of Ham were Cush, Mitzrayim, and Phut, and Canaan. Noah and his wife were both white. Their children were naturally of the same race. One of Ham's sons was Mitzrayim, meaning Egyptian, and we know from all Egyptian art, including their marvelously fine portrait sculpture, that during all the many, many centuries of Egypt's greatness, they were a pure white people. In fact, during all that time, any Negro found in Egypt, other than a slave working in chains in the fields, was summarily killed on sight. Ham's other son, Cush, was no doubt also white. Now, what about the land of Cush? There were two different countries named Cush in Bible times. One was Ethiopia, lying south of the Sudan in Africa. But there was another Cush in ancient times. It was in eastern Mesopotamia, or what at other times was a part of the Babylonian Empire. These people were certainly not a black race at any time. This Cush flourished for about 300 years, centered around 1500 B.C., in other words, in Moses' time, for the exodus from Egypt occurred in 1486 B.C. Now, who can we expect to find living in this Cush on the east of the rivers Tigris and Euphrates? And from what people there did Moses take his wife? In the first place, note that there is absolutely nothing in the Bible anywhere which says or even hints that Moses ever was in Ethiopia or any place where he could have found a Negro woman to marry. And if he had gone to Ethiopia, no doubt the Ethiopians would have killed him on sight as an Egyptian. The Bible does tell us where Moses got his wife and who she was. You remember that Moses had killed an Egyptian who was beating an Israelite. In Exodus 2, verses 15 to 21, we read, "Now when Pharaoh heard these things, he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian." And note, by the way, that Midian is nowhere near Ethiopia. "And he sat down by a well. And the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, 'How is it that ye are come so soon today?' And they said, 'An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds, and also drew water enough for us and watered the flock.' And he said unto his daughters, 'Why is it that ye have left the man? Call him, that he may eat bread.' And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter." So we know positively from this that Moses married the daughter of the priest of Midian. The priest's name, Reuel, means friend of God. It is given in the variant form of Reguel in one or two places. And sometimes he is called Jethro. Jethro is an English mangling of the Hebrew word Yithro, which means His Excellency, a title of respect, not a name. So, who were the Midianites from whom Moses got a wife? In Genesis 25, verses 1 and 2, the Bible tells us that after the death of his wife Sarah, "Then again Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah. And she bore him Zimran, and Jokshan, and Medan, and Midian, and Ishbak, and Shua." So Midian was a son of Abraham. But Abraham had been told by God that the great promises to him would be fulfilled only through his descendants by his son Isaac, and not through any of his other sons. He therefore gave his inheritance only to Isaac. But he loved his other sons too, and he dealt fairly with them. In Genesis 25, verse 6, it says, But unto the sons of the concubines which Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac his son while yet he lived, eastward into the east country. Logically, he would want them to move more than just a few miles, as the whole idea was to send them far enough away that they would not be neighbors of Isaac, quarreling with him over the inheritance. The next place of any importance to which they could go was this kingdom of Cush in the valleys of the rivers Tigris and Euphrates, the same country which at other times was part of the important Babylonian Empire. So Midian and his descendants became Cushites, people living in the kingdom of Cush. But remember that by race, they were descendants of Abraham, close blood relatives of Isaac, and his descendants the Israelites, although they remained a separate nation and never became part of Israel. Since this is the only wife that the Bible tells us that Moses had, it is clear that she was a Midianite whose family lived in Cush in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. That is where Moses would logically have found her. Moses fled for his life because the Pharaoh of Egypt wanted to kill him. He couldn't have gone just to some tiny neighboring kingdom to stay. They would not have dared to give him shelter, but it would have turned him over to Pharaoh as soon as the Egyptians learned he was there and made a demand for him. Moses fled a safe distance to a land where the people did not live in fear of the powerful Egyptian empire. In other words, to this Cush, among whose people were the Midianites. We may be certain that Moses never married a Negress. Remember that he was brought up in the Pharaoh's palace as the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter. He was educated as an Egyptian of the royal family. The Egyptians considered the Negroes as mere wild animals to be killed on sight. The son of royalty would not take a wife from the Negro Cush in Africa. It was while Moses was guarding the flocks of his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, that God appeared to him in the burning bush and commissioned him to go to Egypt and set God's people Israel free. When he returned to his own people and taught them their proud heritage as God's people and that they must keep their race pure, his brother Aaron and his sister Miriam taunted him with his marriage outside the strictly limited group of Israel. It is true he had married a woman who was not Israelite, but she was not only a white woman, but a descendant of Abraham and a close blood relative of the Israelites. So this matter of Moses' wife cannot be used as a justification for race mixing. Moses did not marry outside his race, just outside his nation. Mongrelization is equally a sin against both races. The black race should be protected against it as much as the white. God had his own purposes in mind when he made the different races, and each was made suited to the purpose God had planned for it. To lose that suitability by mixing it with another race is to defy God, and the results of that are always bad. My subject for today is Ruth was an Israelite. It is unfortunate that many preachers in their ignorance teach so much false doctrine. One such false doctrine is the statement that Jesus Christ was only a mongrel, not of pure Israelite blood. They say that one of his ancestors was Ruth, a Moabitess. From the use of this term, they believe she was racially, not just geographically, a Moabite. In this, they are greatly mistaken. The territory of the Moabites was originally east and northeast of the Dead Sea, extending from the river Arnon on the south to the river Jabbok on the north, and from the Dead Sea and Jordan River on the west, across the plains and foothills into the mountains to the east. From the name of the people who lived there, it was called Moab, and it kept that name for many centuries after all the Moabites were gone from it. When the Israelites entered the Promised Land after their 40 years of wandering in the Exodus, the land of Moab was the first territory they conquered. God had commanded them to totally exterminate the former occupants of the lands they were to settle, and in Moab they did so. At that time, about 1450 B.C., Sion, king of the Amorites, had conquered and occupied the kingdom of Moab and was its ruler when the Israelites came in. In Numbers 21, verses 25 and 29, we read, "For Heshbon was the city of Sion, the king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab and taken all his land out of his hand, even unto Arnon.
Woe unto thee, Moab! Thou art undone, O people of Chemosh. He hath given his sons that escaped and his daughters into captivity unto Sihon, king of the Amorites. The Israelites conquered the land of Moab, killing all the people they found therein, as God had commanded them to do. We read in Deuteronomy 2, verses 32 to 34, Then Sihon came out against us, he and all his people, to fight at Jahaz. And the Lord our God delivered him before us. We smote him and his sons and all his people. And we took all his cities at that time, and utterly destroyed the men and the women and the little ones of every city. We left none to remain. However, some few escaped by fleeing out of the country into other lands. From here, the Israelites advanced northward into the land of Ammon. Numbers 21, verses 30 to 35 describes it. And they turned and went up by the way of Bashan. And Og, the king of Bashan, went out against them, he and all his people, to the battle at Edrei. And the Lord said unto Moses, Fear him not, for I have delivered him into thy hand, and all his people and his land. And thou shalt do to him as thou didst unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, which dwelt at Heshbon. So they smote him and his sons and all his people until there was none left alive, and they possessed his land. This entire area, east of the river Jordan, was settled by the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh, after all the original inhabitants, the Moabites and Ammonites, had been either killed or driven out. In Deuteronomy 3, verses 12 to 16, Moses tells us, And this land which we possessed at that time, from Aroer, which is by the river Arnon, and half Mount Gilead, and the cities thereof, gave I unto the Reubenites and to the Gadites. And the rest of Gilead and all Bashan, being the kingdom of Og, gave I unto the half tribe of Manasseh. And unto the Reubenites and unto the Gadites I gave from Gilead, even unto the river Arnon, half the valley, and the border, even unto the river Jabbok, which is the border of the children of Ammon. All of this was accomplished about the year 1450 B.C. From that time on, this was purely Israelite territory, even more so than the land west of the river Jordan, because in the old lands of Moab and Ammon, none of the original inhabitants were left alive. Today, Anglo-Saxon Americans who live in California are called Californians. But bearing this name and living in a former Mexican territory doesn't make them Mexicans racially. Likewise, pure Israelites living in the old land of Moab were often called Moabites from the place where they lived, just as those who lived in Galilee were called Galileans. 300 years later, about 1143 B.C., we find evidence that the Israelite occupation of the lands of Moab and Ammon was still unbroken. Judges 11, verses 12 to 26 says, And Jephthah sent messengers unto the king of the children of Ammon, saying, What hast thou to do with me, that thou art come against me to fight in my land? And the king of the children of Ammon answered unto the messengers of Jephthah, Because Israel took away my land when they came up out of Egypt, from Arnon even unto Jabbok and unto Jordan. Now therefore restore again those lands peaceably. And Jephthah sent messengers again unto the king of the children of Ammon, and said unto him, Thus says Jephthah, When Israel came up from Egypt, and walked through the wilderness unto the Red Sea, and came to Kadesh, then Israel sent messengers unto the king of Edom, saying, Let me, I pray thee, pass through thy land. But the king of Edom would not hearken thereto. And in like manner they sent unto the king of Moab, but he would not consent. Then they went along through the wilderness, and compassed the land of Edom and the land of Moab, and pitched on the other side of Arnon, but came not within the border of Moab, for Arnon was the border of Moab. And Israel sent messengers unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, the king of Heshbon, and Israel said unto him, Let us pass, we pray thee, through thy land into my place. But Sihon trusted not Israel to pass through his coast, and Sihon gathered all his people together, and pitched in Jahaz, and fought against Israel. And the Lord God of Israel delivered Sihon and all his people into the hand of Israel, and they smote them. So Israel possessed all the land of the Amorites, the inhabitants of that country. And they possessed all the coast of the Amorites from Arnon even unto Jabbok, and from the wilderness even unto Jordan. While Israel dwelt in Heshbon and her towns, and in Aroer and her towns, and in all the cities that be along by the coasts of Arnon, 300 years, why therefore did ye not recover them within that time? So the Israelites had held unbroken possession of the land of Moab and Ammon that entire 300-year period. Right in the middle of this period, about 1322 B.C., or 130 years after the Israelites of the tribes of Reuben and Gad had occupied the land of Moab, Elimelech, a man of Judah, with his wife Naomi and his two sons, was driven by famine out of Judah. And Ruth 1, verse 1, says that he went to sojourn in the country of Moab. Note the accuracy of that expression. Not among the people of Moab, but in the country of Moab, which was occupied by Israelites exclusively. His sons married women of that country, one of them being Ruth, who became an ancestor of David, and through David an ancestor of Jesus Christ. She could not have been of any race or nation but Israel, because no others lived there. Indeed, it could not have been otherwise. From the beginning, God very strongly condemned the Moabites and the Ammonites. In Deuteronomy 23, verse 3, he commanded, "An Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord. Even unto their tenth generation shall they not enter into the congregation of the Lord forever." In the tenth generation, there could be less than one part in a thousand of Moabite blood. Yet forever, a person with even one part in a thousand of Moabite blood could not enter into the congregation. And God was always consistent in this, as he is in all other matters. In Zephaniah 2, verse 9, we read, "Therefore, as I live, saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, surely Moab shall be as Sodom, and the children of Ammon as Gomorrah." The whole 48th chapter of Jeremiah is a terrible condemnation of the people of Moab. In prophesying the triumphant return of Jesus Christ, Isaiah tells us in chapter 25, verse 10, "For in this mountain shall the hand of the Lord rest, and Moab shall be trodden down under him, even as straw is trodden down for the dunghill." Certainly God would not take from a people whom he condemns like Sodom one to be an ancestor of Jesus Christ. So never let anyone tell you that Jesus Christ was only a mongrel with the blood of other races flowing in his veins. God was so insistent that even the least peasant among his people Israel must keep the race line pure under penalty of being cut off from his people for violation of this law. And Jesus Christ said, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I came not to destroy, but to fulfill." We have the clearest proof that both as God the Father and as God the Son, he was consistently true to his own commandments. Ruth was an Israelite from the land of Moab, but not from the race of Moab. Today, let's talk about God's immigration law. When I first spoke to you on the subject of the laws of God, we saw that God's laws are divided into four classes: commandments, judgments, statutes, and ordinances. That the commandments are the major rules governing man's duties to his God. The judgments are the rules governing man's relation to other men. The statutes are the general rules for the health, prosperity, and peace of the nation, including the dietary and agricultural laws, the social and economic laws, and the political laws. And finally, the ordinances are merely the religious regulations for the various rituals and sacrifices and offerings. Of these, none but the ordinances have been set aside by the New Testament. The rituals and symbols embodied in the ordinances were the expression of the Israelites' belief that his Redeemer would come in the future. But when Jesus Christ had actually come and performed the reality which these rituals symbolized, their usefulness was then ended. The believer could no longer say that he was waiting for the future coming of his Redeemer. That would be a repudiation of Jesus Christ who had already come. So these ordinances must be replaced by new rituals which look back to the accomplished redemption. But the other laws of God are still in force. Thou shalt not steal and thou shalt not commit adultery are as important today as when Moses carried the stone tablets down Mount Sinai. We do not expect to gain our personal salvation by keeping the law, and indeed this was never their true purpose. But we do expect to gain the peace, prosperity, and good order of our community thereby, just as we have tried to do this by enforcing the laws of our city, our state, and our nation. Let no one be misled into thinking that God's commandments, judgments, and statutes have been set aside by the New Testament. These are permanent laws. In Matthew 5, verse 48, Jesus Christ tells us that God is perfect. Naturally, so are His laws. The 19th Psalm tells us, "The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." Do you say, "But Christianity is all spiritual, so we have abolished the law?" Not so. In Romans 7, verse 14, Paul tells us that the law is spiritual. And in Romans 3, verse 31, Paul says, "Do we then make void the law through faith? God forbid. Yea, we establish the law." Just as our perfect God exists forever, so do His perfect laws. For Psalm 111, verses 7 and 8 tell us, "The work of His hands are verity and judgment. All His commandments are sure. They stand fast forever and ever, and are done in truth and uprightness." And Jesus Christ Himself says in Matthew 5, verse 18, that not the tiniest part of the law will pass away until heaven and earth pass away. And as we see in Revelation 21, this is not until after the millennium. Jesus Christ's triumphant thousand-year reign has been completed. Now let's consider some of these laws and what they mean to us today. Our political parties today have sold out our God in a corrupt and evil deal to get the support of minority groups. For the sake of temporary power and graft, they would destroy all our greatness forever. And to do this, they are now in the process of destroying the immigration laws which have protected our nation. They now demand that we admit indiscriminately all the world's overflow from pagan lands who hate our God, from Asian and African lands whose people are totally impossible to assimilate, and who must either remain a hostile enemy bloc within our borders or else mongrelize and destroy our own race if we mix with them. But God expressly forbids this. While it is recognized that there will be some aliens here as students, merchants, and so forth, and that these are to be treated with honesty and justice, the anti-Christian race, those who hate our God, are expressly forbidden even to be allowed to live here. In Exodus 23, verse 33, God says, "They shall not dwell in thy land, lest they make thee sin against me." And no aliens were ever to be allowed to become numerous, lest they devour the land or the people's strength, as Isaiah 1 verse 7 and Hosea 7 verse 9 says. We were warned if we let them become numerous, they will fill themselves with the people's wealth. That's Proverbs 5 verse 10. And Ecclesiasticus 11 verse 34 warns us that if we receive a stranger into thine house, he will disturb thee and turn thee out of thine own. Have you ever wondered at the long genealogies of the various people mentioned in the Bible? There was a good reason for this. Their genealogy proved they were of true Israel blood and were entitled to take part in the affairs of the nation. Citizenship was not given out for two box tops and a dime to all who came along. Those who were of closely related bloodlines, but not actually of Israel, could only be admitted to citizenship in the third generation born in the land. Today, an immigrant hardly need be off the boat long enough to get over his seasickness before he can start the process of becoming a citizen. We do not require nearly enough time for aliens from some parts of the world to really learn our way of life. Oh, they can and they do memorize certain things which they must be able to recite on their examination for citizenship. But these things pertain only to the mere mechanics of our government, not to the ideals which led the founding fathers to use those mechanics to make us great. Under God's laws, as set forth in the 23rd chapter of Deuteronomy, those who were not closely related to us in race could not be admitted to citizenship ever, not even after 10 generations born in the land. By violating God's laws, we have now accumulated considerable blocks of unassimilable aliens who have been given the vote. They hate all the ideals of this land, to which they came only to get more money. And now our political parties are selling out the great American majority in bidding for the support of the alien minority groups. Under God's laws, no one of another race would be allowed to hold public office. Deuteronomy 17, verse 15 says that, "Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, one which is not thy brother." The one translated stranger is the Hebrew word nokri, which means not just someone you haven't been introduced to, but one of another race. That persons of other races could reach positions of power is clearly stated to be merely a curse which comes upon us for our violation of divine law. In the 28th chapter of Deuteronomy it says, "But it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of Yahweh thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. The stranger that is within thee shall get up above thee very high, and thou shalt come down very low. He shall lend to thee, and thou shalt not lend to him. And he shall be the head, and thou shalt be the tail, because thou didst not hearken unto the voice of Yahweh thy God, to keep his commandments and his statutes, which he commanded thee." We have been persistently led away from the laws of God by certain liberal political groups who don't even claim to represent the majority of our people, the white Christian Americans, but who openly represent only alliances of minority groups. These politicians call themselves liberal. This also was known to God thousands of years before it happened. And he also told us of the true character of these politicians. In the 32nd chapter of Isaiah, the prophet is telling us of that time which is yet to come, when the kingdom of God will be fully established and operating as it should be. And he tells us that when that time comes, then the vile, V-I-L-E, vile, the vile person shall be no more called liberal. Godspeed the day. For more than 30 years, our politicians have betrayed us, the great majority, seeking the support of certain disloyal minorities. The result has been the adoption of policies both at home and abroad, which have brought us to our present position, facing a war in which we must fight for our very existence. If we had obeyed our God in the making of our laws and our national policies, these evils would not have come upon us. In the 48th chapter of Isaiah, we are told, "Thus saith Yahweh, thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, I am Yahweh thy God, which teacheth thee to profit, which leadeth thee by the way that thou shouldst go. Oh, that thou hadst hearkened to my commandments! Then had thy peace been as a river, and thy righteousness as the waves of the sea. But there is no peace, saith Yahweh, unto the wicked." What wickedness? Ours. In letting evil and treacherous politicians displace the laws of God, replacing them with platforms written to see who can stoop to the lowest baseness to buy minority votes. When will we learn that only by following the righteous laws of God can we gain the peace and prosperity of God's people? And of these laws, none is more important than the immigration laws designed to keep our race pure, that we may remain God's own people, Israel.